Thank you very much. The next case is Bush v. United States. Mr. Redding.
Good morning, Your Honor. If it pleases the Court, I'd like to first start out with a general observation. If this dismissal under 7422H in this case is sustained, then it renders any tax court decision in a TEFRA proceeding that is favorable to a taxpayer a meaningless piece of paper, because the taxpayer would have no forum in which he could then come back to the court in a refund case and say the government did not properly apply that decision. That is the ground that we're citing here. We're not arguing that the court should re-evaluate whether or not the partnership's transactions were tax motivated. We are very plainly, clearly, and explicitly arguing that there was no tax motivated determination in the controlling opinion. The controlling opinion in this case gets a little complex because it is based on a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction motion that, contrary to the normal statutory rule in a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction, for failure to prosecute, would sustain the FPAW in full. The government came in and asked for alternative adjustments that were not consistent with the FPAW, and you also have the underlying prior order by the court that the partners in the Dillon partnership and the other Denver partnerships would in fact be subject to the decision in Krauss. So what you really have here is a final dismissal in this case that applies that prior determination that Krauss would control. So you really have to look at Krauss, not simply what is contained in this dismissal. The government has made basically the same argument, expanding Pratty and Deegan way beyond what they did. In the Irvine case, in the Southern District of Texas, the court in that case ruled in our favor on this issue. That case is now on appeal in the Fifth Circuit. But
what relevance does our Keener case have?
Keener is very relevant. Keener and Pratty, they seem to address a similar issue. But in those cases, when you read the case, you'll see that the court in every instance determined that there had been a prior TMT determination and that therefore our only claim could be to seek redetermination of that prior determination. Here there has been no such determination. In fact, this case is exactly what the Keener case specifically says. Keener was not. There's a quote in the case, and I can't recite it exactly, but it basically says, you know, the taxpayers assert that this would be, or that the claim could be, that there was no prior determination. That's not this case. That's what's said in Keener. Well, that is this case in this instance.
Do you read Keener to keep jurisdiction open then in the instance of a tax-motivated transaction?
Yes, for certain types of claims. You cannot come back and seek a new determination of what the partnership level transaction was or what its nature was. You cannot come back and seek to overturn a prior determination of that. But as in any instance where you are going to another court to enforce a judgment by a different court and saying to that court, we either want to defend based on that judgment or we want to enforce that judgment, the court naturally has the authority to look at that judgment and see if it does what the party is alleging.
If the court below reaches the tax-motivated transaction determination,
yes,
won't we be defeating the purpose of having one partnership level proceeding?
No, sir, we're not. Because, again, if you were going back and addressing whether or not there was a tax-motivated transaction, yes, it would be. But that is not what the court is being asked to look at. It's being asked to simply look at that judicial proceeding and see if there was a TMT determination. And if there was not, then the government's imposition is completely wrong. It's inappropriate. That comes up in the second part when we talk about the three-year statute, but the six-month statute of limitations, but dropping to that for just a second to make this point, that is equally relevant there, because the six-month statute of limitations applies to where the commissioner has erroneously computed any computational adjustment. It doesn't say any erroneous computational adjustment assessment. It says where the commissioner has erroneously computed a computational adjustment. The government in this case would have you expand that to mean any invalid or improper computational adjustment assessment. Well, that in turn would make the new statute that was enacted in 97, the additional subsection C, subsection, or paragraph, in 6231C that talks about claims that the IRS erroneously imposed a computational adjustment.
But do you agree that the laws that previously existed applies in this case? As the
6231C1A, the six-month statute,
yeah,
does not apply to this case.
Okay.
It was in effect, but it's not the type of claim it relates to. The type of claim it relates to for the first time became subject to that six-month statute in 97, when they included claims that the commissioner had erroneously imposed a computational adjustment. The government would have us read out the term erroneously computed from 6230C1A, which defines the type of claim that's subject to that statute as a claim that the commissioner of the IRS erroneously computed a computational adjustment. Now, if erroneously computed doesn't mean something, it shouldn't even be in the statute. It's superfluous. Not only that, to read it that way renders 6230C1C enacted in 97 completely meaningless, because it would have already been covered.
Have other courts done what you're proposing here to look beyond to see if there's a...
Absolutely, Your Honor. In the Fifth Circuit in Duffy held, in looking at the same issue, Duffy held that the court, the refund suit court, clearly has jurisdiction to make two determinations with regard to 6621C post-TEFRA. One is simply the $1,000 threshold issue, whether or not the understatement of tax exceeded $1,000. And the language in Duffy was directly adopted by the Fifth Circuit, so this is really a Fifth Circuit opinion. It says, and whether or not a TMT determination had been made. And that is exactly the issue that we seek to litigate here. Did Krauss, as applied in this case, did it constitute a TMT determination? And that is what the court at the Fifth Circuit addressed in Copeland and said, no, it's not. Krauss didn't make a TMT determination. And it's complicated to look at Krauss, because Krauss was a mishmash of pre-TEFRA, post-TEFRA, and even post-TEFRA partner level litigation that was all consolidated together.
But you're telling us, I gather, that the Fifth Circuit law should apply, and Duffy should apply, because these taxpayers are in the Fifth Circuit, and therefore that the Court of Federal Claims can't choose the law of the Ninth Circuit, for instance.
I don't assert the Fifth Circuit controls. I'm asserting the Fifth Circuit as very compelling precedent, because it directly addresses these issues.
Okay.
And there is no directly compelling authority in the Federal Circuit. on the issue of the interpretation of Krauss. I think you look there at Hill versus Copeland, Ninth Circuit versus Fifth Circuit. And I think the Fifth Circuit analysis and argument is extremely compelling. It's correct. The Fifth Circuit says that you can't apply 183 at the partnership level to begin with. And it makes that analysis by relying on it relies on the language in the definition in Section 183 itself, in the statute, and also in the regulation adopting a 183 disallowance as a TMT. Those are two different things. They both contain languages that reads as follows. Any deduction disallowed for any period under Section 183 relating to an activity engaged in by an individual or an S corporation.
Why didn't your clients appeal the Vulcan Oil dismissals? Aren't you getting a second bite at the apple here?
No, Your Honor, we're not. There is no reason for our client to have appealed the Vulcan Oil dismissal. There was no determination in that dismissal of a TMT. Why would he appeal it? Furthermore, our client actually has no right of appeal. The Cooks are a less than 1% partner. That makes them a non-notice partner who has no right to appeal the case. Our client couldn't have appealed the case.
Okay. Do you want to save your rebuttal time, Mr. Reddy?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Hauser.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I think it's absolutely clear in this circuit that 7422H bars the Court of Federal Claims from issuing refunds attributable to partnership
rights. Unless there's no TMT. Don't you have to look and see?
You can't look to see whether there was a partnership transaction was a TMT.
Well, Keener says pretty clearly, leaves jurisdiction open if there's... Don't you have to check into that tax-motivated transaction status?
Not into the status of the transaction
itself.
Keener
leaves that open, doesn't it?
Into the transaction of the status itself to relitigate whether the partnership transaction was tax-motivated? I don't think Keener leaves that open at all. The status of the partner... Whether the partnership's transaction was tax-motivated is quintessentially a partnership-level determination. Whether that determination was made, we might be able to look into here, but not whether that transaction was tax-motivated.
Did anyone look into that?
In this case?
Yes. Isn't that the thing the trial court absolutely refused to look at?
But,
and just said, all I see is partnership, I'm through.
Because it was looking at this court's determinations in Keener and Pratty, which clearly indicated that even the question, in the Pratty decision, this court indicated that even the question whether that was made, if you are questioning the underlying partnership-level determination, that is a partnership-level issue. So looking at the question, was Krauss correctly decided, that's a partnership-level issue. That is now closed. It's too late to look at the question, was Krauss correctly decided? And that's what the Court of Federal Claims was refusing to do here, refusing to go under the final partnership-level determination and consider something that would affect...
How do you determine if the refund is a partnership item without checking into the tax-motivated transaction status?
They're claiming a refund, they're arguing for a refund that would be available to them if the partnership did not engage in tax-motivated transactions. Right? Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding.
Okay. So, that...
If they're not, and they say, we're not.
They say they're not seeking a refund.
No, they say we're not involved in a tax-motivated transaction.
But whether the partnership was involved in a tax-motivated transaction was a question for the partnership-level proceeding.
It seems to me like you've got to at least take a look at both, right? Don't you have to at least look to see if there's a tax-motivated transaction?
I feel like we must be talking about slightly different things.
Let me suggest
a sort of simplified version. Imagine the IRS issued an FPA determining a tax-motivated transaction and that 6621C interest would apply. And that FPA was never challenged and became final. And then the IRS issued 4549A's stating that 6621C interest would apply and the taxpayer paid and sued for a refund. We would say that TMT determination was made at the partnership level and could not be challenged in the partner level proceeding. That's the point I'm trying to make.
What I see the court doing is looking and saying, I see in this case a partnership, I'm not even going to check any further and see if there's a tax-motivated transaction. Is that what happened?
If that is what happened, if that's how you read the Court of Federal Claims opinion, then I think they...
That would be error, right? Because you'd have to at least look.
You'd have to at least look to see if there was a tax-motivated transaction determination.
Yes.
You wouldn't look at the underlying facts to see if there was a tax-motivated transaction.
But you'd have to at least look to see if you've got jurisdiction.
Yes, that would be a way.
Okay. Assume for a moment that I'm reading it exactly that way.
Okay.
The court refused to do that. Show me that that's wrong. Show me how the court is correct. It seems to me it's wrong. It seems to me it refused to make even the superficial check for a TMT that's necessary to determine if you've got jurisdiction.
The court is correct that whether a TMT determination was made is a partnership item. It might nevertheless have jurisdiction under 7422H through the 6230C exception to section 7422H for a claim that the adjustment was erroneously computed when applied to the partner level. But it was absolutely correct that this is a partnership item, and that it cannot look to the merits of the partnership item. And since the arguments the taxpayers are making here are about the merits of Krauss, whether Krauss was correctly decided, how Krauss should be interpreted.
But three courts have recently said Krauss didn't make a TMT determination. Can't we look at that? Am I correct on that?
I believe that Hill and Hildebrand both upheld the TMT determination, the imposition of 6621C interest. And those are the cases that are directly evaluating Krauss. Krauss isn't relevant here as precedent or even as persuasive authority. It's relevant here as part of the history of the case.
If three courts have said Krauss didn't make a TMT determination, why don't we look and see?
Because Krauss is a partnership level proceeding, and the partnership level proceeding is now closed.
You're talking about the Ninth and Tenth Circuit cases. I'm talking about Copeland, McGann, and Bartimol, right?
But those are not appeals of the tax court decision in Krauss. They're not part of the procedural history of that case.
This seems like such a simple matter, and I don't seem to be even communicating with you. Why don't we just have the court take a look and see if there's a TMT here? That is, it's almost a question of, in order to, you've always got jurisdiction to determine if you've got jurisdiction. So you've got to look and see if you've got jurisdiction. The way you do that in this instance is check on a TMT.
check on whether there was a TMT determination.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. There was a TMT determination. It's a... And I've suggested three cases have done that, reached a different conclusion than the Ninth and Tenth Circuit cases that you're talking about. We just want them to look.
I think it's important, again, to draw the distinction, looking to see if there was a TMT determination in the tax court proceeding does not mean looking to subsequently decided cases that are not part of that procedural history.
Look for that TMT determination. That sounds to me like you're saying what I'm saying.
All right. In that case, the other point I would like to make is that the statute actually provides for that. You don't need to...
And I'm reading that the trial court to not have done that.
Well, we
and therefore have erred. Have made a superficial determination that skirted their obligation to at least see if they've got jurisdiction.
Well, I don't...
Under that Keener left open, our 2009 case.
Perhaps... The Court of Federal Claims did not use the best language they could have, but I don't think it's that it was a mistake for them to dismiss the case overall, because as we argued in our brief, there was a TMT determination in the partnership level proceeding in the tax court here. So,
did the trial court here even look to see if that was true?
The trial court looked at the history, recited the history of the tax court proceeding at the partnership level. So,
did it look to see if there was a TMT determination?
I don't believe so.
I don't believe so either. Isn't that error?
This court could affirm nevertheless on the record, as we argued in our brief, and also on the second issue that we raised in our brief, which is that to look at whether there was a TMT determination.
We could do the trial court's job for them and make a determination ourselves as to whether there was a TMT determination, or we could ask them to go back and correct their error. Now, are we still communicating?
Yes, I think that's
correct. Okay, thank you.
The second argument we made in our brief was that the statute actually provides, and this goes a little bit to what we were just talking about. We talked about always having jurisdiction to determine your own jurisdiction. We don't need to fall back on that principle here, because Section 7422H actually has an exception for claims brought pursuant to 6230C. And 6230C provides mechanisms for taxpayers to challenge the way that the IRS applied the partnership level determination to the individual partner, so that it can be, you can conclude that a partnership level determination, that a particular decision is a partnership level determination. In fact, I think the question whether a TMT determination was made must be a partnership level issue, is a partnership item that applies equally to all partners. But of course, you can go through the 6230C exception to 7422H in order for an individual partner to challenge that issue in a refund suit.
So you say Copeland was wrongly decided and shouldn't be followed?
I'm saying that Copeland is not relevant here because it's not part of the history of the case at issue. It's also not a TEFRA case. It involves pre-TEFRA years. And so it was not concerned about the it was not in the same procedural posture as this case. Excuse me. So the cases that are relevant here are the Krauss decision in the tax court and the courts of appeals directly affirming that, not other cases later looking back at Krauss as a matter of precedential or persuasive authority.
30 years ago, I worked for the Ways and Means Committee and thought I'd be a tax lawyer. I'm starting to feel very glad that my life took a different turn.
I would like to, just before my time runs out, revert to our claim that Duffy was correct about the timing of a 6230C claim. As I've just explained, the way that the taxpayers can raise this issue here is through 6230C. 6230C claim needs to be brought within 6 months of getting notice of the IRS's computational decision. Here, the taxpayer's claim came more than 2 years after that. Not only more than 2 years after the 4549A, but as the decision in Duffy reasons as well, more than 2 years after the taxpayer obviously had actual notice because they full paid the amount of the interest assessed under 6620. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hauser. Mr. Reddy?
Thank you, Your Honor. First, just as a quick comment. 31 years ago, I became a tax lawyer. I'm happy to say that my plans are that within the next year, I will cease to be one. I'm retiring.
No judgment on those questions. Let's go ahead.
Right. Your Honor, in your review of government counsel, the phraseology kept coming up of whether or not it was a TMT or whether or not there's a TMT determination. And I think those are two completely different questions. We're not challenging whether or not the transactions were TMTs. It was never decided, and it had to have been decided to impose penalty interest. So the real question is simply, has there been a binding TMT determination? And I think putting the word determination on the end there is extremely critical to understanding what this case is about. And in fact, the determination of whether or not there was a TMT determination is not a partnership item, and it's not a claim attributable to a partnership item. If you go into the definition of partnership items, they are things that the government has designated by regulation or more appropriately determined for the partnership's taxable year at the partnership level. That certainly does not apply to what a court did 20 years later. This type of claim doesn't fit under the kind that are precluded by 7422H. I want to make that argument very clear. I would also like to disabuse this court of the misrepresentations in the government's brief and in its presentation just now about the FPAW. There is no determination of a 6621C imposition or of a TMT set out in the FPAW, even if you look behind the Krauss determination. The FPAWs are in the administrative record. I invite you to review them carefully. They say nothing about imposing 6621C penalty interest. Where that confusion comes from is something I mentioned briefly initially, and that's that Krauss was a mishmash of pre-TEFRA, TEFRA, TEFRA partnership level, and TEFRA period individual level matters and cases. Something that it's unclear to me even today how it even came before the court. If you review the first two pages of the Krauss opinion, on the second page, it discusses the issues to be involved in the case. And it talks about the Hildebrands, who were individual petitioners at the individual partner level. And it talks about the petition on behalf of the partnerships and says that at docket number so-and-so with respect to Barton Enhanced Oil, and by notice of final partnership administrative adjustment, respondent disallowed Barton's ordinary losses for 1982 and 83 in the amounts of X and X. But then it goes on, and this is something that it's unclear how it even became part of that case. It says, respondent also determined increased interest and additions to tax under 6621C, 6659, and 6661 with regard to petitioner Gary E. Krauss's 1982 and 1983 individual federal tax liability. That's not addressed in the FPAW. I believe that somehow that case originally even involved a stat notice to the individual partner, Mr. Krauss, that was a part of that case. And I think it's worthy to note that on the final page of Krauss, which is a long opinion, where it addresses the application of 6621C, it says it applies to the petitioners. It doesn't say it applies to the partner. And the only petitioners for whom it was an issue in Krauss, really, were Mr. Krause individually and Mr. Hildebrand individually. It's not in the FPAW. It's not a partnership level issue being determined in Krause, believe it or not. I didn't actually tumble to that until last night. But I asked the court to look at that second page of the Krause opinion. Under TEFRA, there is no way that in a TEFRA proceeding, especially under pre-97 law, that those penalties could even be an issue in the case. There had to be another mechanism by which Krause got before the court. Again, we're not arguing about the merits of the Krause determination. We're saying that Krause did not determine. We're not asking the court to redo Krause. We're asking it to interpret Krause.
Okay.
And I would note that the government asserts that Bartimo and McGann are not relevant, but McGann came out of the Federal Circuit. McGann was appealed even by the government, who then chose to withdraw the appeal and go back and try to get another judge to agree with them to then make us bring the appeal up. If that's not judge and forum shopping, I don't know what is. This case was decided by one judge of the claims court in our favor. They dropped the appeal of it and then made us try it before another judge so that they could get a different case to appeal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Redd.